So hello everyone.
Hello everybody. This is September 11th, 2023, and we have the pleasure of a presenter whom I will turn over to Ortal, who discovered her, to share her wisdom with us.
So thank you, Terry. And you know, the first thing that I asked Judith is if this is enough introduction what I will say about her. She said, please tell them how we met. So this will be important for her. So we met because I arranged webinar in ICF, and Ronnie Gruber, he was the president of ICF in Israel, and he introduced me to Judith. And from that moment, we fell in love, I think, and we had some collaboration together. And I will say a couple of words about you, Judith, and you will add whatever you feel like, okay? I'm so happy and excited that you are here. And I'm sure that you will enjoy from her and from her knowledge. So Judith has been working as a business and executive coach since 2009. She's a subject matter expert in the field of business ethics, since she worked as an advisor in business ethics and complaint for multiple companies, and leads courses in a business ethics and international study program at Corvinus University Budapest, the leading university economic in Hungary. She has 20 plus years management experience in the fields of marketing management at Johnson & Johnson, one of the world's largest healthcare companies. She has started her doctoral program in ethical decision making in 2020 and published regular on this topic. Thank you so much for coming. I'm so happy that you are here.
Thank you very much. It was nice.
Thank you for most welcome.
And it's not me who is interesting here, but I hope the topic what I brought to you today will be inspiring for you to discuss and talk about it. I would like to share my thoughts, what I think about ethics and decision making. My today's presentation will not focus on the ethical part. However, when I started to deal with ethics, I elaborated an ethical decision-making model, which I think it's a very useful tool for coaches and supervisors when they face with any ethical dilemma in themselves or with the client, how they can resolve it. So I just put one slide about this at the end. I guess we do not have time today to talk about it, but just I will show you, and in case if you are interested in, we can continue these discussions. So today, my topic is not the ethics, but the decision making. And I start sharing, Terry, if my slides, because I prepared a nice presentation to you. Okay? Is it okay if I start sharing? But before I start, yeah, just one more thing. I would really, you will see my slides. And unfortunately, I won't see you anymore. But I would really like to encourage you to participate actively in that discussion. So even you can write in the chat box and Ortal will take care of it. Or you can just speak up and interrupt me. So just let's pretend that we are sitting in one room and we are talking about something which is interesting for all of us, okay? So you can interrupt me at any time and yeah. Let's make it a good time together. And now I share my screen. And I start. Do you see it?
Yes, we can see it.
Okay. So the title of my topic is today is that our blind spots on our mental map. And what are the rational and non-rational elements of our decisions in our profession as a coach, in our interventions, what we do with the clients, and what are the blind spots which might limit us to make the best intervention or decision in a given moment. And just let me start with the, I'm just sorry, I just tried to move. Okay, I'm here. Do you see that I moved my slide?
Yes.
Okay, good. So, why do I think that it's important even in the field of ethics? Because I think ethics in many times we think about ethics as something academic. It's something very philosophical, intellectual. But one of my professors in Cornell University, he said, he's László Zsolnai, he's a very well-acknowledged professor in business ethics, and he says that ethics is not an academic study. It's not only or just a philosophy, but ethics is action. Ethics, we can experience ethics in every moment of our life when we do and act in a way or behave in a certain way. And it's not enough just to talk about theories and principles and values, but really what is important that how, what do we do with these principles? How do we deploy these principles and values in our everyday life and in our actions? So when we think about ethics, it's always a decision making. We always have the choice to decide what do we do and decide how do we do the best in a given situation. So when I'm talking about the blind spot, this was in my mind that decision-making process is, I think it's a very important process in our behavior. And if we understand what can hack or how it can be hacked and what are the factors, what can what influences us in our process, we can maybe do something to improve our decision-making skills. So today I thought that I will briefly share my understanding about the decision-making process itself. And I will present this process through describing the rational and the non-rational elements of that process. And then I will elaborate the suggestions that how we can do and manage and what kind of interventions we can do, how we can improve our decision-making skills. And last but not least, if we have time, I will share very briefly with you my ethical decision-making model. So let's start with the decision-making process itself. If you think about the decision-making process, let me ask you that what comes first to your mind, that what are the characteristics and the difficulties of a decision-making? Why can be a decision a difficult thing? What comes to your mind if I may ask you?
Well, the first thing I the first thing I thought of is if you make the wrong decision, you will either judge yourself or be judged by others.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That you can be judged and by others and by yourself. Yeah, thank you, Terry. Jerry?
Another thought is that you might have different important things on the table, and it's difficult to understand what has the bigger value.
Indeed, yes. Anyone else? Thank you very much.
Maybe complicated subject, right? That it's there is dilemma, and I need to decide, and like I have something in my heart that is thinking something else, and my mind is thinking something else, right? So it can be a conflict inside me.
Indeed.
I am sorry. I don't have the image to raise my hand, but I wanted to say that also living with the consequences, that then you may have regrets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed, Claudia, and thank you so much. And I think you covered almost everything what I collected. So this is why I like this kind of interaction, because what the academic literature says that what makes a dilemma and ethically relevant, or why, what is the anatomy, this is how I call the anatomy of a dilemma. It's exactly, Jerry, I think, what you refer to, that there is some conflicting values here, some values which are either competing or conflicting. There is conflicting interests. There are several alternatives. So we have a lot of alternatives, or more than one at least. And Claudia and Terry, I think the last point refers to your comment that that the decision and the impact of the decision has an impact on others. So the question is comes that, so how, and I might ask this to you as well, that how do we know that our decision is right? If you're ever in a situation that you have to make a tough decision, what is your internal benchmark? How you can justify or control whether it was the right decision or maybe not? Any thoughts? Just out of interest.
Yeah. Well, again, for me, I feel it inside if it's the right decision. Even though I might get feedback from the outside, these days I have to check inside too.
And may I ask, Terry, that what is your internal feeling? What is your gut feeling? Where do you feel in your body?
Right, right.
Where? Oh. It's in your stomach, in your center, or how do you feel it?
Oh, you're asking me? Okay.
Yeah.
Most often I feel it in the gut, but sometimes I will feel it in the heart, and even in the head.
Even in the head. Mm-hmm. But something is, maybe it's not right there.
Right. People are raising their hand. I'm happy to
call
on them to do that. Elena, I wasn't sure who was first. I will look there.
I think Elena was first.
Thank you. I think that I use my life purpose to know if yes, and it is related with the energetic intelligence concept that is. As I have my very clear my life purpose, helped me to do the right decision, the decision who aligned with my values, with my thinking, with my heart, and with my gut. No, everything is aligned. So inside of me, when I decide. The signal is that I am in peace. If I did the right decision. Okay.
So if you feel the peace in yourself, you know that you are happy now.
Yeah. Yes.
You are aligned with your values. I'm great.
Thank you.
Natalia?
Thank you. I think that is a mix of everything that you already said, because it's regarding intuition. It's I know that I did in several many ways that I did the right thing, because it was always connected with values, and I feel that I'm okay. I feel with energy, and I think that is right, but it's intuition.
So intuition, very, very interesting that you brought the intuition in, and you will see later why. And I really like how you emphasize that you become energetic. You have the energy. So it empowers you. And this is how you know. Yeah,
empowers me for an action.
For action. Yeah, thank you.
Vision, energy, action.
And Lourdes and Orta, and then we can move on, I think.
Okay. In my case, it's very hard for me to make decisions. And it's because I try to balance intuition and then the rational part. So sometimes I go from one point to another until I really feel comfortable with the two parts, but it takes some time.
Kind of balancing one, that what your rational, your mind suggests you, and what your heart.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I love it. You will see why in a couple of slides.
Okay.
Ortega, thank you, Lord, very much.
I think sometimes my intuition says something, but there is something that I don't think about. And only when I see the reaction of the other, I can understand if it was the good decision. So the first step is to ask myself. Sometimes it's not working with the other, right? And so sometimes I can learn from the other what does it mean about my decision, if it was good or not.
Indeed. And now, thank you so much for your reflections and sharing your what is your relation to your decisions. And now let's move on and a little bit explore that when we work as a coach or when we work as a supervisors, how the blind spots appear in that space and in that interaction. So I think when we enter in any interaction with our client or with our supervisee, the first thing what comes is that the coachee himself or herself just enters to that space, to that common space. And whenever he or she enters there, she or he brings his own history. He brings the information, the data, what he has about his topic and the problem or issue. And he comes in with emotions, really, and some thoughts. He has got the beliefs, and he has got his own blind spot. All of us has our blind spots. So he is one in our common space. And on the other end, we also bring into that space our history, our memories, our experiences, all the data and information, what we have about this specific case and what we have in general. We are always, with our blind spots, and we have the emotions as well. We have the thoughts about things, and we have also beliefs. And in this very common and mutual space, we share the data, and we have create our common thoughts and emotions about a certain situations. So when we are think about our interaction in our profession, the blind spots, I can say that everywhere. So it can appear from different sources. And why is it important? Because if we work as a coach and our role is to support our client, it's the process has always two main parts. And when I created this slide, I know that the decision-making process itself has been described in very, very different ways. External factors, internal, external factors, what are the context, what are the situations. So very, very different type of classification, how these processes analyzed and studied. In that context, what I found it meaningful and maybe interesting, if I use the following classification, that the whole decision-making process has two main part. The first part is the rational part. This rational part of the process just consists of two things. One is the data, the information, what we have. This makes our brain work and calculate. These are the data. And on that part, there is the bias, the so-called cognitive bias, which can distort the full understanding of the information what we possess. And I will talk about these biases, that what type of biases I think it's important here in our work. These are the rational part of the process. The other part of the decision-making process is the so-called non-rational part. And I will talk about it, that why is it non-rational and not irrational a little bit later. And in the non-rational part, I identify two things which I think is really important and impact the outcome of our decision. The first is the emotions. The emotions what the client have, the emotions what we have, or the emotions which are there, and the intuition. This is the second one. And this out of these four elements, what I think it's important, if we think about the blind spots comes from the cognitive bias on one hand, and from the emotions. The cognitive bias, how I interpret it to myself and how it helped me to understand this, I consider cognitive bias as the effort or the attempt of our brain to make sure that it works efficiently. So it is a kind of optimization approach from our brain. Just to save time and energy. And it's interestingly, this very smart approach can just mislead us, because during that efficiency or optimizing process, important information can be fell out from our mind. Okay, so this is the cognitive bias. So I will talk about some words about the type of cognitive bias, which I think it's important. And on the second part, I will talk about the role of emotions and intuition. And before I go to this kind of academic details, I just thought that maybe I will bring you a quiz. You can test it and we can talk about how these kind of biases work. So please just don't think too much. Just have your quickest gut feeling and to answer this question. That if I ask you that, what do you think? What is the number of MCC credentialed coaches of certain countries, I will share with you later. Just guess the numbers, okay? What do you think? And I created two groups. And what do you think that which group is larger, bigger, in terms of number, okay? So this is, and don't share now, just make a note, because please share it later, okay? Just for you. And I give you, I think, 15 seconds, not more, because really it's important to be quick there. So which group is bigger? In group A, there is the country Israel and France. You can make your guess. And in group B, Hungary and Spain. Make your educated guess. What do you think? Which group has the higher number of MCC credentialed coaches?
Do we have to answer in the chat?
Just
keep it for us. Thank you.
Just for you, and later you can. We will come back. But you know, first we just make your individual guess. Keep it for yourself for a time being and share it later. Okay? If you are done, don't spend too much. It's just a kind of game, and we can move on, okay? So if you have your guess, then I will move on. So when we think about the rational decision, I think it's an interesting question that what do we consider a rational decision? I have the feeling that we love to believe that we are so rational and we are so smart and we are so ready to optimize our decision. And when it's a good decision, it can be rationalized and we can justify by facts. And what I think it's interesting here, that what is considered as a rational decision, I just would like to refer to the work of Herbert Simon. I'm sure that all of you heard about him. He's a Nobel Prize political scientist and a psychologist as well. And he said that we consider a decision rational or rationally justified if it is built on data, so it's data-based, it is alignment with the individual's values and convictions, it is consistent or logical, and last but not least, it can be placed in one axiom system. So it's a kind of holistic, we can argue for that. The question is now that are we able, what do you think, just a quick feedback, what do you think, are we ever able to make a rational decision, or it's just a theory?
Just the theory.
Is this the theory? Yeah, and yeah, indeed. And he, based on that, he argued and he launched the phenomenon or the description of bounded rationality. I think you heard about this, and he said that of course we are almost never in the situation that we are able to make a fully rational decision. And why is it so? It is so because we do not know always all the alternatives. We can never ever possess all the data. We are very often, I think, or we are almost, I might say, uncertain regarding the probability of events. And we cannot calculate all the consequences of our decision. Therefore, automatically, in most of the cases, we are just explore our problem in a narrower scope than which is typically available. And last but not least, and I think it's also interesting, and this is the characteristic of us human being, that in most cases, if we are desperately seek for a good answer, whenever we find a good one, which is good enough, we tend to be stopped if we under time pressure. We don't search for more because we are so happy that finally we got there. And therefore, we can say that in our decisions are hardly ever fully rational. There is always more. It's a question, of course, I mean, it's a long debate, and if we have time, we can go in that whether how much and how much detail we should go in certain cases and how we can calibrate that, how much effort we do to find a better solution. But in general, we can know that we can state that generally we explore just a limited scope versus the potential scope. And now let's go quickly to review some type of the cognitive bias, which is the explanation, the psychological explanation, how our brain hack our rational thinking. So let's focus on that. And I brought you four. And of course, in the literature, there are much, much more description about the different type of cognitive biases, but I selected those four, which I thought that it is really important in our everyday practice. Okay, so it's a subjective selection. The first one is the simplification, the first cognitive bias, which I saw that it might be interesting to talk about here. And this explanation, simplification, just belongs to Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, two psychologists, and Kahneman received an economic Nobel Prize for this work. And I'm sure that you heard about their work, which is the Thinking Fast and Slow concept. And what they say and what they discovered, that our brain has two type of functioning, how our brain forms the thoughts, what we have. The first system is the so-called the fast system, which is very immediate. It's very automatic, very intuitive and unconscious. This is what first comes to our mind. It is the primary system in our brain, and it is very emotional. It is driven by the emotions. This is fast, like this. And the second system is the slow system, which is more effortful, very calculating. This is the kind of analyzing state of our brain, very focused. It is the conscious, and it's the secondary. And it explains that when we are under time pressure, the first what is activated is the system one, and it can deviate our thinking immediately. So if we really want to analyze carefully, we need to devote the time. We need to give the time, the focus, the attention to activate the second system, the system two here. So simplifications, and simplification is a very natural process, because if we just let's think about it, if we were spending hours in every morning to find out whether there is a better way to make our morning coffee, and we would really do this very rational analytic thinking, it would be very, very ineffective. So simplification is a very good process in general. I wouldn't argue against it. But I think it's important, and this is a kind of awareness, to feel whether it's not enough, and have the awareness and understanding that if we need more, then we just have to do the additional effort to activate the system two. So this is the first cognitive bias, which I thought. The second one is, and I think maybe if you look at the picture, the photo, it comes to your mind that what can this be? It is the anchoring bias, what is called anchoring bias. And the anchoring bias, it is a just describes the tendency that the information, what we hear first, or which is the newest or the freshest, or it has the this we use as the benchmark automatically. If I were said, for example, in my example, that what do you think in France or in Spain has a more number, has more MCC credentialed coaches, what do you think it is, over 1,000 or less? Then automatically you would start to think that, okay, maybe it's 1,001 or 900. But you start to use my first step as a reference point. And this is the anchoring bias. It can be used in negotiation, in a bargaining, and it can be very manipulative, to be honest. It's important to know, and it naturally happens, because you start to think in a different scope. If I put you as a different reference point, whether it's around 1,000 or it's around 100, what do you think? I just drive your thinking to a certain direction, Okay, so anchoring bias means that the first information overly influences the decision making. And it's why it's important in our work. Because even when we listen to our client, when we are in the situation, the information, how it is shared, kind of influences us and directs our thinking naturally. It's very automatic. The third bias is, what I thought that might be interesting here, is the availability heuristic. And what this suggests is that those information which is easier accessible to us, or we can, it's easier for us to look it up, we automatically tend to use it more as our reference point than the other information. So we have to be careful about this as well. Because what is easier for us to access, this is what we tend to use as a benchmark. Okay? And the last what I thought is important here, or might be relevant here, is what can this be? The framing. And framing it means that how the other party frames its problem. It counts much, much more than we might think about it. What scientists find that the style of the framing just really influence on the decision-making process. And what it means, that for example, if we describe the situation, and the positive aspect is emphasized, then automatically we tend to choose those options which is less risky, which has a higher probability, or we think it's the higher probability, unless if exactly the same situation is presented in a way that the negative side is just highlighted and emphasized, we tend to choose a riskier solution. And it's a natural intent of us that we focus more to avoid harm. And if the case is presented from the negative perspective, we are more able and ready to take some more risk, which I think it's also interesting. So these are the four biases, which I thought that it might be interesting also in our work. And let's see that what are the factors, what can reinforce this bounded rationality. And I thought about this already. The one is the time pressure, that if we have to make the decision quickly, and the other factor, what significantly influence our bounded, naturally bounded rationality, is the emotional pressure, whether it's external or internal. It doesn't matter, both has a high influence on our decision making. And regarding the emotions, I'm not there yet, but now that we went through on these cognitive biases, just let me ask you that, what do you think? That what is the number of coaches? Which group is higher? Group A, Israel and France, or?
Would you like us to answer or to write? Or whatever?
France. No, you can answer now. Just, there is no stake for that.
I would say Group B.
Group B, so Hungary and Spain.
Yeah, me too.
I think A.
Okay, so we have someone who would vote for Group A, and we have someone who would vote for Group B. And just very briefly, may I ask your reasoning, that how did you come to that conclusion? What was your math?
No reasoning at all in my case. No, I just remember a conversation with someone, some French people who said that there were very few MCCs in France. So this is the data.
I have a rationale. I think there are more coach in Spain and in what was the second one? Yeah, in Hungary than in Israel and France. In Israel for sure.
So your approach was something nice that you calculated that the number of total coaches which are higher, and then automatically you just proportionalize your thinking.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, I share you the number. In Israel, there are 10. I use the ICF, the coach, ICF website. So I just, what is there is there, but it actually doesn't matter really what is the, this is, it was the 2 days ago data. Okay, and in France it's 60. So it's altogether 70, and in Hungary 20. And in Spain, it's 54. So group B is higher. But I think it's interesting that how do we approach a question to find an answer? Because we can use some data reference, which are the number of coaches. What is our knowledge about the number of coaches? What do we know about the country? What do we know about the economic development of the country? What is our maybe feeling toward, what do we think about the culture of that country? What do we think about the importance of our profession and the importance of credential in general? So it's a lot of factor what can influence. And even if we think that it's a gut feel, there are some data reference and there are some emotional, which comes from our history or our experience. Okay? So I think even in that very simple practice, we can see how the biases work and influence our thinking.
Judith, sorry for disturbing that. There is some people that wrote in the chat. I don't know if you can see it. For
no, I don't see it.
Okay, good.
If you think it's important now to share it, Orta, let's share it. If we can come back to that later.
You can continue.
Yeah.
They like what you represent.
Okay, thank you. So this was the kind of rational part of the decision-making process. And now let's a little bit deep dive on the non-rational part of the process, which is, in this area, I would like to talk about the emotions, the role of emotions, and the intuition. Just let's start with the non-rational part of thinking. And when I prepared this presentation and when I was thinking about this concept, in Hungarian, we typically use as an antonym to rational to irrational. But in the scientific literature, they don't use rational, irrational, but they use rational, non-rational. And I really, maybe it's funny, but it was interesting for me a little bit deep dive and understand really that what is the difference of it, because I think there is a good reason to do it. And I was so happy to understand it, that the rational is which we can say that something is rational if it can't be explained by any reason. And irrational, in the definition, it's when it's not logical or not reasonable. The non-rational is if we cannot explain by any reason. And you see the difference? It's very interesting because I think the non-rational implies that it might have some rational roots or some reason, but we do not understand yet. The irrational, which goes against the logic. And therefore, I think I really like very much this scientific approach, that rational and the non-rational part of the decision. And the non-rational, when we do not find at the moment, because of our current knowledge, the reason of it. There is no explanation yet. And this is why we call it non-rational. Okay? And the first is the emotion. And I think one of the most important non-rational part of our decision-making is the emotional involvement. How does it impact our decision? And I can open up the platform, but I think maybe we can. I don't do it now because I think it's very, very obvious that it can impact our decision in two ways. The first is that when we have positive emotions about the situation, we tend to overestimate our ability. We just don't count that we have limitations. We feel limitless because we are so overwhelming with the positive emotions. But if we have some negative emotion, like fear, anger, this is narrow and simplify our options. It just narrows the scope because we are shocked, we are stressed. So I think it's both. The emotions can support us, but they can really cause some problem for us because it takes our rational thinking about our ability to rationally analyze things, because we either overdo it or we underdo it. So this is about emotions. And the last topic which I thought that might be interesting, and I think it's very important here, and some of you, maybe Lord, you mentioned intuition. It was you. You are below me, so this is what on my screen. So intuition. What do you think about intuition? If I might ask, do I have time, Orta? Do I still have time?
Yes, Judith, you have 10 minutes.
Maybe this one has to a little bit speed up, but I really would love to ask this.
Yeah, what do you have 10 about, minutes.
Okay. What do you think about the intuition? Or what do you know about intuition? Okay, I just... Mm-hmm. Okay, Elena, I saw your hand. I see your hands.
For me, intuition is an amplified state of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. An amplified state of consciousness. What do you think? What is the origin of intuition? Is it come from the conscious or the unconscious?
I think it comes of the mix of everything. Mm-hmm. But it's more unconsciousness than consciousness. But for me, it's a mix. And it's a result of the sabiduría. ¿Cómo se dice esto?
Knowledge?
No, sabiduría. Wisdom. Of the wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or talent, and then we will move on.
The inner conversation that I have in my... in myself.
The inner conversation. Okay, so I checked several definitions and how the scientists describe intuition, that it's a natural cognitive process which origin comes from the unconscious and comes from our past experience, which is interesting. So the origin is the unconscious, but when we verbalize it, it becomes a cognitive, but it is a quick, it belongs to system one, the fast, comes from in depth, so very intuitive, automatic. And then when we think and analyze, it becomes a cognitive. And this was interesting also for me. So it's Yeah, this is what I just described, that unconscious, it's a cognitive process, and it creates a very quick judgment. And this is what we call moral intuition, which is immediately followed by moral reasoning. So first we got the intuition, and then we immediately start to look for the justification, look for data to justify it. So intuition can be very useful and can be misleading, because it comes to from our past. And if our past experience is not relevant to that situation, it can mislead us, unfortunately. We love to believe that our intuition works so well, and even if it works well, sometimes it's not much to do with the present. And it's okay, we need to be aware of. But why intuition is so important? I think in our work, we consider intuition so important. And why is it so? And when I was thinking about this, I found the work of Wilfred Bion. It's an English psychotherapist. And I really liked his thought about this. Because what he said, that intuition is our essential skill in coaching, in therapy, to be connected with our client. But since it comes from our past experience, to be really on the same platform with our client, first, we have to possess this so-called negative capability, which means that as a therapist or as a coach, we have to learn how to clean up our brain from our past experience, to be able to join to the client space. And this negative capability requires us that we are just hanging in an empty space. And this makes us humans very uncertain and anxious. And we have to be able to cope with that anxiousness and nervousness. And I think it's very important to learn how to do it. So intuition is very important, and this was my summary here. So I know that we are running out of time, so I'm just quickly wrap up here, okay? So the question comes that, okay, it's an interesting topic, and now we know, and so what? So what can be the interventions, how we can work with this knowledge to resolve this bias? And it's my recommendation, but I think it might be interesting to think about it, that in case of the rational element, I think in rational elements, the time and the space is always important. Give the time and the space and the attention to our client and ask our smart questions. Ask the good questions, which opens up and widens the scope, which was narrowed by him or her. Okay? So this is the place for the good questions. And what do you think that what happens on the non-rational part, in case of emotions? In case of emotions, time and space also important, but I think good questions doesn't help there. But empathy, have this negative capability, is more important. And when the emotions are a little bit really decreased or just settled, then we can start to ask good questions. But I think it's important that if we realize that our client has a lot of bias or blind spot in his story, what intervention we use, it's very different. And how does it appear in the space? I think that we as a coach or a supervisor can bring our active listening skill, our intuitive attention, the negative capabilities, and we can use the imagination, that we are able to imagine, to project something different, what we have, grow. And if we bring this into that space, we give the time, we create a safe place, we ask the good questions and have the empathy, then our coach or our client and really work on how to increase his or her awareness, gain the necessary insights, and accept what he is, and start to think about the action, what next, how to resolve it. And this is the imagination here. And this is my model, but I want, I think we have no time, because I would really like to spend the last 5 minutes to a little bit have your feedback. But the model what I created, it's just a brief introduction. I think it's a very simple tool, and it helps us to work with the dilemma in a structured way, and it can help us to work on our blind spots in the given space. And these are the steps, but really I don't want to get into the details, but I just wanted to show you that I brought here.
We invite us next year.
So this was it, and now I stop sharing, and I hope we have a couple minutes, and
Thank you, Judith. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and I'm here.
Yeah,
we have 2 minutes.
Do you have any question?
Any question or feedback, or was it interesting for you? Was it important?
I'm afraid we're going to need to hold those questions for the future. And I want to thank you very, very much for having presented this thought-provoking presentation on a topic that we all think we're very familiar with. However, you really you diagnosed and analyzed it and did a good job of that. Thank you very, very much. And thank you, Artal, for finding Judith. And on December 6th, we won't have anything in October, right? Right, well, because we have a retreat coming up. We'll have lots there. So in November, we have Michelle Sugarman, right? And that's on the 6th of November for that event. We have many sun events. So see you then. And thank you again. And thank you, everybody, for being here. And go do whatever you want to. Use your intuition today.
Thank you very much, Julie. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.